This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the LGIM investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. If you're enjoying LGIM Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcast or Spotify app to make sure you never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Colin Reedy, Co-Head of Global Fixed Income, and James Carrick, Global Economist. As ever, our podcast listeners can find a link to the slides in this episode's show notes. Well, quite a lot has happened since our last call back in early December, not least the fresh wave of COVID-19, the Brexit deal, and of course, the recent events in the US. So with no further ado, Sonia, good afternoon. What's the latest on the pandemic, the global economy, and the state of financial markets?
Thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to all of our clients, and wishing you all a very happy new year. And as always, I wish that you are joining us today healthy and safe. As Max has just said, clearly a lot has happened, and if there's one thing that seems to not have changed if you look at 2021 compared to 2020, then it is the speed with which events are unfolding in front of our eyes. And the first week here in January now has not been different. We're talking politics here, particularly Brexit and in the US, and clearly obviously focusing on the dreadful news around the virus developments and the rollout of the vaccine. So what I would like to do now is just try and set the scene before then delving a bit deeper into specific topics of what we feel are the most important areas for investors to focus on throughout 2021. So here on the slide in front of you, what we've tried here is really focusing on the most important influencing factors that we feel will determine not only the economic developments in 2021, but clearly will give us a clear insight into investment opportunities as well. First and foremost, vaccine development probably has now moved towards vaccine distribution, and the rollout clearly creates headlines every day, and it seems that there's a very uneven success so far how countries are managing that rollout, but it clearly is in direct conflict with the negative news from the virus spread, so we are trying to get our heads around how quickly governments really have to roll out the vaccine in order to be able to remove some of the very severe lockdown restrictions that have been imposed over the Christmas and New Year's area. So these are the two most important trends right now. And if you think about the market developments, then it seems very clear that for the time being, investors are still sticking to the light at the end of the tunnel, assuming that the vaccine development and the vaccine rollout will eventually allow restrictions to be removed. And as such, we are looking towards an economic recovery in the second half of this year. And this is clearly the positive news that markets for the time being seem to be very much hanging their hat on. Policy support, as you can see, is the only unanimously positive element in the whole equation, and this is no change from what we have seen in 2020. As you know, that we have seen unprecedented support from central banks and from governments, and just to give you some statistics around this, during the period March to September 2020, we have seen the G4 central banks expand their balance sheets to the tune of roughly 17.5% of GDP. And obviously, as we know from all the recent communication from central banks, it is not supposed to change. And as such, we assume that the monetary policy support will remain as stimulative and as supportive as it has been throughout 2020. When it comes to fiscal, likewise, we have seen unprecedented measures being announced throughout the year 2020. And actually, ever since the start of the pandemic in 2020, we have seen a total of around $12 trillion in fiscal packages being announced on a global basis. I think the overall policy support as such is incredibly supportive, but we will have to look forward and see how important this is in driving markets forward. And I think fiscal policy in particular will play a very, very important role, not only in 2021, but beyond. areas we would like to focus on today as well is the concept of economic scouring. And as you recall, this is a topic that we have brought up in previous webcasts and webinars because we feel it's incredibly important to understand what the long-term implications are of the very unusual economic recession, and in particular, the very unusual interference with our social lives and what implication this might have in terms of our overall behaviors and obviously in terms of the implication on the economic developments. Politically, we have had a lot of news last week. One, obviously, is the Brexit deadline finally came to an end at the end of 2020, and by 11 p.m. on the 31st of December, the UK finally left the EU. And as you know, there will be a lot that we are currently digesting in terms of the agreement that has been put in place for trade, but clearly from our very selfish point of view, we are obviously keenly awaiting the initiation of discussions around services and the trade agreement that can be reached here. So, looking at the economic developments, as you know, we have had a scenario analysis in place, and you can understand that right now we're focusing a lot on the potential near-term implications of the most recent lockdown measures. But clearly, if you know, consider what I said just now, it is not only to understand how Q1 might shape up, but clearly whether this is simply a timing shift, i.e. because of the more severe lockdown measures right now, is it simply that the cyclical recovery will start later, or do we have to assume that the lockdown measures right now will actually change the overall economic expectations for 2021? So for the time being, we assume this is mostly a time shift, and James in particular will focus on our assumptions around economic scouring. But clearly this has wide implications, in particular when it comes to overall market expectations and what we should think of the most interesting investment opportunities in 2021. Now, to finish off the introductory parts, this is a snapshot that you're seeing right now in front of you of the asset returns across a broad range of asset classes. And as you know, 2020 did turn out to be a rather positive year across a large number of risk assets. And hence, I think investors quite rightly will ask right now, with that level of returns seen in 2020, and in particular with valuation levels where they are, you know, how much of the good news is priced in already, and how high is the risk of a potential disappointment? And I think disappointments, we will discuss a number. You know, if you think about the immediate situation around the vaccine rollouts, we've had already quite a few hiccups, because if you think about the huge undertaking of a mass vaccination, it's clear that we have to assume that there will be a few unforeseen issues, and as such that it might either take longer or it will have other implications that might mean, because of the severity of the current COVID situation and the new infections, that the implications will be far more reaching. Are markets, in fact, happy to look through this again, or is there room for disappointment? So that's probably the most important questions to look at, alongside, obviously, what to expect from the political situation, and here, in particular, around the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, and obviously the very nasty events that we have seen in the U.S. this week. With that in mind, I will hand back to you, Max.
Thanks, Sonia. Yes, let's stay with the theme of geopolitics. James, what's your view on the long-term economic impact of Brexit for both the UK and the EU, now that the transition period is over and the EU trade deal has indeed been signed?
Thanks, Max. Yeah, so Boris Johnson described the Brexit as a Christmas gift. And it reminds me of those electronic toys that we get for Christmas. They're nice and shiny. We're really excited about them. But then you realize that the batteries are not included, and it eats through batteries, and it therefore costs you a lot more money than you were anticipating. And so, yeah, we've got this shiny Brexit deal, but we're already seeing some problems in terms of bureaucracy and holdups and delays between the EU and the UK, and some companies find it very difficult to export and higher prices. And that will also weigh on investment decisions longer term, particularly for third parties like Japan. Will they continue to support a manufacturing base in the UK, or would they prefer to have a manufacturing base within the EU's borders? There's also the issue of migration. We obviously had a lot of migration into the UK from the European Union. Now that's supposed to be restricted with a points-based system, a salary minimum. So those two effects, the non-tariff barriers, the bureaucracy, and also reduced migration, would be expected in the longer term to reduce UK GDP. Estimates suggest it should be between 0.25% per year over a 15-year period. The interesting thing is whether we've already taken a lot of that blow already, and Hettle points out in her blog how UK business investment has massively underperformed the rest of the world, the US and Europe, since 2016. So we would expect weaker investment that might already have happened. In terms of how it hits the EU, well, the UK is less important to the EU than the EU is to the UK. We're about a quarter of the size. So you'd expect some problems, but about a quarter of the size. And obviously, it'd be more a problem for our near neighbours in Ireland and in France and the Netherlands than it would be those further overseas. And in terms of the migration angle, well, it's a kind of, if the UK is taking fewer migrants from the European Union, there are more people in the European Union to work. So that would be a slight boost. And again, maybe some of the longer-term manufacturing decisions could boost the EU. The final point is on the politics, and it's often been argued that the UK was obstructing closer European integration, and maybe that could accelerate. But as we've seen with the likes of Hungary and Poland, there are other areas of disagreement within the EU, even if the UK has left. So it's not clear that we get a radical change there.
Well, thanks, James. Christmas seems a long time ago right now. Moving to COVID, do the virus variants and more severe lockdowns change your view on economic scarring? And what, if anything, can policymakers do about this?
Thanks, Max. That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, the more severe lockdowns and the longer lockdowns mean we have a continued period of below normal activity. And if we just put central bank and government policy reaction to one side, you would expect that to lead to more scarring, because more companies and households have a hit to their earnings, their pay, their revenues. That means they have more debt or they have fewer savings. And when we can go back to normal, you have to repair those balance sheets. You have to pay off the debt. You have to cut your costs to repair your credit rating. You might have gone bust, and in which case the bank has an exposure to a credit card, a car loan, or to a corporate loan, or to a commercial property, which is no longer earning any money. And so banks tend to respond to those losses by tightening the availability of credit, and that has repercussions further on. Even if we can go back out to normal, you have losses in the system, and that becomes self-reinforcing. But as Sonia alluded to, we have seen unprecedented policy action, partly because inflation was low. This wasn't a recession caused by policymakers over-tightening. It was an exogenous shock, and they've been willing to ease dramatically. And we have been worried about interest rates being at rock bottom and out of policy ammunition there, but we have been pleased to see the use of fiscal tools. And indeed, right now, we're becoming more optimistic on the U.S. because it looks like the new U.S. administration, with the Democrats taking Georgia, can help more fiscal stimulus in the United States. So ordinarily, we would say deeper and longer lockdowns means more scarring, more problems for the banks. But we are seeing policymakers respond just as rapidly. So it doesn't really change the big picture that much, because we presume that furlough schemes are extended, more fiscal stimulus, extended monetary stimulus. And so you're left with scarring, but it doesn't necessarily multiply and multiply.
Thanks, James. Well, this is a great point at which to bring in Colin. Colin, against the economic and policy backdrop that James has just described, and of course the results of last week's Senate election in Georgia, what's the outlook for global fixed income markets?
Thanks, Max, and good afternoon, everyone. So we actually published our quarterly outlook last week, and it was in doing so that it dawned on me that I honestly don't think I've started a new year where there are just so many big pieces of the jigsaw moving at the moment. The possibilities that exist for the next couple of years are genuinely fascinating, and most, if not all, revolve around the extremely powerful forces at work currently in the background. If we bring it to right here, right now, despite the very difficult backdrop that we're all facing, we're still inclined to look through the near-term challenges of further lockdowns and their economic consequences, but we have to acknowledge that it would also appear markets are trying to do the same, given how 2021 has begun so far. As with anything virus-related, a healthy dose of humility has always been required so far, and this should extend to vaccines as well. But we think and hope that a tail risk based on the vaccines simply don't work against new strains or whatever is a relatively low probability event in our opinion. And instead, if markets can get comfortable that the ultimate peak in cases will be this month or as soon as possible, hopefully, and we can actually get closer to the other side of the hill, as it were, then it does become easier for markets to face through the current challenges. You mentioned the Georgia election, Max, and that was actually quite important in this context, I think, as we weren't sure how much patience could be built into valuations at these levels, and did also have concerns that a correction could be possible given northern lockdowns and their knock-on impact on first quarter GDP numbers, which we've discussed, obviously. So we think our concept of looking through has probably improved a little bit with the Democrats' success in Georgia. On that valuation point, again, something that we featured heavily on in the quarterly outlook, there is absolutely no trace of the pandemic in 2020 asset class returns. I think it's important to acknowledge that. We've had double-digit equity gains, credit did pretty well, all things considered, and commodities did just fine as well as it happens. We could have obviously forecast all of that 12 months ago, but only on the assumption that there wasn't a global pandemic. So for us, you have to acknowledge that recovery in some shape or form is very much in the price of markets based on current valuations. I mentioned those big pieces of the jigsaw that are moving around in the background as a result of all this. So I should probably touch on some of those here. We've highlighted in the past the strong signals sent by central banks that monetary policy is bordering on exhaustion with rates and yields down here. The required response to a global pandemic and the subsequent government-mandated closure of economies has, as with a lot of things the virus has done, effectively accelerated the baton being passed from monetary policy to fiscal policy, in our opinion. So the question we've been really focused on for a while now is, for how long are policymakers going to run their economies hot? And by hot, what we're saying is with the fiscal and QE taps fully flowing. And I have to say, I think my conviction around this has probably gone up with new information we've received over the last couple of months. if we break some of that new information down, the Georgia runoff doesn't give the Democrats legislative freedom, the so-called blue sweep that was being discussed prior to the election, but it does put them in the driving seat. President-elect Biden should be able to appoint pretty much who he wants without the Republicans holding any of those appointments to ransom, and that's quite important in this context. The key appointment for us is the first female Treasury Secretary, a name we're all familiar with, Janet Yellen. We think the Biden-Yellen combination is extremely dovish in this context. History tells us, while at the Fed, she was more than happy to bail anyone out in a crisis, but it's more than that, to be fair. If you've ever heard her speak or read her speeches in detail, Janet Yellen is a true believer in running economies hot and that it will genuinely help with inequality issues and disadvantaged groups of society. Genuine true believer with that. So if you take that set of beliefs and set it against where the United States of America currently finds itself societally, and you can see the desperate need for the new administration to start the long, difficult process of trying to put the country back together, you know, you start to be able to put some of these pieces of the jigsaw into place, and they slot in pretty neatly, I have to say. That then leads us to the next big question. You know, will policymakers hold their nerve when things start to normalize, vaccines get deployed globally, and economic growth recovers, possibly very swiftly in the second half of this year? I think the political and intellectual backdrop has probably changed sufficiently that they may well do. When I talk about the bonding of monetary and fiscal policy, just look at who's steering the ship going forward. We have an ex-head of the Fed running the Treasury Department now, and we have an ex-politician running the ECB. This is a very, very different backdrop and set of challenges to the ones that have sat behind a 30-year bull market in fixed income assets. You know, again, another shift of these, you know, these big issues. What are the risks around this? Well, the key risk is obvious, and that's what's happened in Japan for 30 years. They simply check it out. You know, debt levels get to a point, you know, where policymakers blink first and decide action is required to reduce deficits as the rating agencies start to circle and have a look at individual countries' sovereign ratings. You know, to be fair, you know, as virus numbers improve, you know, it's going to become harder to keep these taps open. You know, policymakers will lose the urgency to support the recovery and could start to step back. If you remember, the pivot to austerity in 2010 after the global financial crisis is now widely viewed as a policy mistake. I'm not saying any swift move to austerity is the key risk here, but given how reliant markets have been on policy support measures, you can see my concerns are justified. There were decent-sized corrections in risk assets in both mid-2010 and mid-2011 as a result of this shift. Just bringing it back to valuations and markets, my personal view is it's not hard to view recent price action and risk assets as pretty speculative and largely liquidity-driven. You don't need to look further than Bitcoin as far as I'm concerned. I'd probably throw in Tesla for good measure here as well. Bitcoin is pure froth in my view. Although that said, I have friends who are true believers. But the only argument I can buy into is the greater fool one, I'm afraid. although that wonder who's the bigger fool at the moment, because they've made some decent money on the back of this, and yours truly hasn't. Right. Maybe I'm the mug. We've used the term that credit is price perfection, and while that certainly applies, we think, to high quality credit, it's maybe more that credit, with the lowest ever all in yield, just can't afford for anything to go wrong here. And it's not as if we don't have a few banana skins in the road ahead. But I guess to counter all of that on the bullish tack, you know, we've talked about policy response. There are almost biblical amounts of cash sloshing around the system. All of it is chasing yield and return, and you know, I don't think that can be underestimated either.
Right. Well, thank you for painting that fascinating picture of the year ahead, Colin. J- briefly, before we turn to equities, where do the global fixed income team see the most opportunities?
Well, I mean, we're still relatively constructive on that sort of look through investment thesis. I don't want to make everything about 2010, but you know, during that period, you know, in high quality investment grade stood still, didn't deteriorate too much, but there was still opportunities in some of, how would you classify it, probably the more challenged or tarnished aspects of the credit market coming out of the global financial crisis. So, you know, tier one bank debt, CLOs, some of these sectors still offered value, and there are comparable sectors coming out the back of last year where value does exist. It's in those higher yielding asset classes like EM and high yield, which is the areas where we're sort of currently most focused on.
Right. Well, Sonia, looking at equities and in light of your earlier comments about the supportive factors and also what Colin's just said about some of the potential froth in markets, can stocks continue the strong run they've seen back from the depths of the crisis last March?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And obviously, everything that Colin has just highlighted around the backdrop and the assumptions you have to make apply to equities as well. And I think equities have been incredibly interesting because we have seen not only obviously risk assets rallying overall, but we have seen a real gap opening up between growth and value styles. And that is something that obviously has over the past couple of days provoked the reaction from Jeremy Grantham, the co-founder of GMO, who actually thinks that there's an almighty bubble building in tech stocks in particular and in equity markets in general. And Howard Marks from Oaktree responding today, actually not saying that investing in value stocks right now is not necessarily an easy trade and a guarantee to get good returns. And it shows the dilemma on how to look at equity markets, because as the charts show you, equities have had an almighty recovery from the lows back in March, April 2020. But what you're seeing on the right-hand side in particular, it has been a very narrow market leadership. And I think that is a special factor around equity markets that we have not seen to the same extent across credit markets, and clearly now poses the question, is this the end to the tech rally, and are you simply just rotating out of growth into value? And clearly, if you think about the potential for a cyclical recovery, so everything that Colin has highlighted, we have unprecedented support, particularly for 2021. The stimulus will remain in place, which means that as soon as we can remove the restrictions, we will see a cyclical recovery unfolding globally. And as such, that is historically always been a good backdrop for risk assets and for equities in particular. And it should help broadening the market leadership. It should help the value sector. But I think we have to be a bit careful around just, you know, simply really switching over from one style to the other, because we believe that there have been a lot of structural trends that have accelerated throughout the crisis. And that means potentially that the picture of investment opportunities is not as straightforward and requires further analysis. So, for example, tech clearly has been a real winner of the pandemic, and that has been broadly priced in markets. Yet if you think about the future, and if you think about, for example, the future of work, then it's very clear that the use of technology, the need for cybersecurity, the need for equipment, for services, and the like, will continue to grow. There will be further innovation. And as such, just to say no longer buying tech, I don't think we'll really capture what is currently unfolding in front of us. Likewise, do we really think that it is the time to outright buy into banks and energy and other value categories? Probably not. So it is really about understanding the structural drivers that are happening and then really look at it against the backdrop of the unfolding cyclical recovery that we are expecting. And I think that will give investors a better insight where opportunities remain. And ESG, for example, is another one. And this is clearly supported by governments really focusing on the idea that you should use the opportunity, in particular the fiscal measures and the fiscal means that have been put in place, to make sure that the recovery can kickstart and accelerate the shift towards green energy and a more sustainable recovery. And that in itself will obviously mean that the structural shifts we're seeing will create different opportunity sets from the ones we have seen post the last recession and the last cyclical recovery. And so although we have to be very mindful of valuation levels, we have to be very mindful that actually the equity recovery so far has been outright driven by multiple expansion, not by earnings growth, and that clearly for those valuation to be justifiable, we need the earnings growth to come through. And so just having said that, it's very clear that the risk is that the economic recovery obviously is pushed out far longer because of either a hiccup in the vaccination rollout or obviously the requirement to keep lockdown measures in place for a lot longer than what we currently anticipate. But it gives us a good idea on what the underlying assumptions are, what the market is currently pricing in, and then hence look at the opportunity set in the future. One word just to finish off on the idea around the fiscal stimulus, and I want to echo what Colin has just said. The need for fiscal stimulus to remain in place is incredibly important, and the risk around stimulus measures to be being removed too prematurely is, to our mind, a real risk to markets, because it's very clear to get the exit velocity in terms of economic momentum and growth is incredibly important to get us out of the very long-term 30-year downtrend in nominal growth and obviously everything that Colin has said alongside yield and interest rates.
Well, thanks for that, Sonia. Just looking, we're getting a lot of client questions through right now. We'll try to answer as many of those as possible in our final 15 minutes. Colin, this is a question that we received last week from one of our clients, which is, what's the outlook in 2021 for the yield curve in Europe and the UK?
Sure. Thanks, Max. So the knee-jerk reaction within risk-free government bond markets so far, as far as the sort of reflation backdrop, has been for curves to steepen, as I'm sure you've all seen. Inflation breakevens have also moved. This has been sort of probably most notable in the US. Our rates and inflation team think we're sort of fast approaching the sort of show me stage of this year's reflation move so far. That is, you have to see either, further large sort of fiscal spending or actual signs of inflation coming through. Now, the problem with the latter is it's tough, given what's going on currently. But if we sort of fast forward, 3, 4, 6 months, something of that sort of order of magnitude, then it will be genuinely interesting to see what happens when a year and a half pent-up demand hits and a potentially impaired supply curve. That's what markets are sort of starting to have a sort of more sort of detailed think about. Closer to home, the euro curve is almost entirely flattened by scarcity issues given ongoing ECB buying. Been a theme for a little period of time now. It is possible that issuance from their new EU recovery fund could put some upward pressure on core country and semi-core country yields, but I don't think we're overly concerned here. And bringing it right into our postcode in the UK, we think the MPC will continue to dangle the prospect of negative rates at the front end, but that will probably support the whole curve, to be honest. Given the current economic backdrop, it's important to point out that, remember, the UK has had the deepest recession in the G10 so far, and we are obviously front and centre and now trying to deal with this new heightened strain as we speak. On negative rates, just finally for me, we're obviously used to them in the EU. And while I acknowledge that, you know, the portfolio rebalancing effect can be powerful, I personally feel their damage to confidence and financial stability far outweighs the longer-term benefits. Currently, Governor Bailey is happy to keep sort of talking the talk. Still have to sort of wait and see if he's actually prepared to walk the walk with that. I think ultimately we don't think he will, but this is just yet another example of these very powerful forces that are going to be facing off against each other for the next couple of years.
Right. Are vaccination programs being designed to allow for the swift reopening of economies? And, you know, when do you think we're likely to return to something approaching normality?
There's two areas of this. There is what we call herd immunity, whereby once a certain share of the population is immune to the virus through either vaccination or having had it already, the virus will naturally die out. The problem with that is this new mutant strain of the virus, which is now dominant in the UK, is at least 50% more transmissible than the old strain. And that makes that herd immunity strategy extremely difficult to achieve. Before, you'd need about 60% of the population to be immune through vaccination, having caught it. But with a 50% more powerful transmission mechanism, you need practically everybody. The alternative strategy is to minimize the social costs. And by social costs, I mean the constraints on healthcare capacity, which mean that when you treat somebody with COVID, you have to cancel operations for other patients. And that was one of the questions we got, and we did a blog on this. If you vaccinate 25% of the population, you get everybody over 60. That gets rid of about two-thirds of intensive care unit visits. If you were to vaccinate 40% of the population, 40, you vaccinate everybody over 50, and that eliminates about 85% of intensive care unit visits. Thereafter, you get diminishing returns. Obviously, younger people with comorbidities can also be targeted. So I think that's the strategy that they have to do, target the most vulnerable members of society so that you can gradually reopen the economy but minimize the social costs and maximize the economic output. Unfortunately, and this is all hot off the press stuff, this new strain makes that choice a lot harder because it's you cannot risk reopening the economy because that this new strain is much more transmissible.
Well, thanks for that, James. We've had a couple of questions about inflation and the US dollar. So I think let's just combine them into one. I'll put to you, Colin, which is, do you think that the dollar is likely to continue the trend we saw last year of kind of broad weakness? And what's the outlook, the broader outlook for inflation this year in light of your comments about sort of reflationary forces building?
Yeah, so no, I think it's probably sort of covered most of the inflation angle. It really for us is how we reopen. We sort of, it's very easy to get sort of bogged down in the sort of doom and gloom of right here, right now. But equally, you should sort of turn that around 180 degrees and challenge yourself about potentially more euphoric reopening of economies and societies as, you know, as we get closer to sort of herd immunity or higher sort of vaccine penetration. As I say, you know, we've been unable to sort of do what we want to do for you know, quite a long period of time now. And I think, you know, this is obviously not a normal recession. Therefore, I think we will come out of it in a not normal way as well, or I at least think we should be open to that possibility. So it really is about, you know, what happens when society sort of rubs its hands together and goes, well, I only live once, so I'm going to get out there and get back to enjoying my life with everything that sort of entails. And and whether the supply side is sort of able to sort of cope with that at the time. You know, it's not a huge stretch for me, I think, to see, you know, a sort of short cyclical upswing in inflation in that dynamic. But I would also, you know, highlight that this is a raging debate within LGM at the moment. There's quite a wide bid offer on a range of views here, so should be open to sort of all possibilities. And I guess just finally to the dollar, yes, I do see that trend continuing. That's certainly one of the reasons why our emerging market debt team are constructive on their asset class, that tailwind that they receive from weaker dollar.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Colin. So in our last 5 minutes, Sonia, I think I'll just point a couple of questions your way and then ask you to sum up. So we've got one which says, you know, there are no attractive places to put money. So other than spending it, what does one do? And the other question asks about, you know, where we see value across asset classes and sectors in 2021. So do you want to just answer those and then add anything you'd like to wrap up?
I will give it a try.
Thank you.
And in summarizing a lot what we've said, because I hope it was clear the way we are looking at 2021 and beyond really is making sure that we are looking at the big influencing factors and to look through those and make sure we have an understanding on how they will influence the economic trajectory and hence how we then have to look at valuation levels across asset classes and what this means in terms of investment opportunities. Our base assumption, as it was very clear throughout, is that we will see a cyclical recovery throughout 2021 because we do assume that vaccinations will be applied successfully and that it will allow governments then to reopen economies. That might sound straightforward, but it is the base assumption you have to take because if you do not believe that this is happening, your case around the economic recovery cannot hold up. But with that base case in mind, and this is why we're always looking at the individual influencing factors to make sure if there were a change in trend that we can adjust our understanding of the consequences. If that is the case, in combination with the policy stimulus, and I hope that was very clear from all of us today, again, this is another assumption that both monetary and fiscal policy remain as supportive and stimulative as they have been throughout 2020, because that is the combination that allows us to be constructive on risk assets. Now, there's a big question whether you want to buy into risk assets in the form of a beta call or whether, and I hope this was very clear, as we would prefer, you make sure that you have a good understanding around the long-term structural drivers, the changes that we're witnessing across consumer behavior, across companies, and how they have to adjust to the new normal, because that will have a very different outcome on the back of this than what we might have anticipated prior to the pandemic. So we are constructive on risk assets. Now, very near term, with all the negative headlines, yeah, and it's probably fair to say that you can probably wait until there is further clarity on the vaccination rollout, or it is a kind of phased entry into the market. In terms of valuation levels, I think we've highlighted already where we see obviously the tightest valuation levels, i.e. the least attractive in terms of the further outlook. I think we've highlighted EMD and high yields across the credit spectrum. And I think with regard to equities, interestingly, we would favor markets outside the U.S. It's very clear that the U.S. is the least cyclical of the global equity markets. And if you, like us, believe in the cyclical recovery, there's more upside outside the U.S. And within different sectors, there's a couple of themes that we think are very interesting to look at. I've already kind of introduced the idea of accelerating change, and it's something we've discussed a lot throughout our webinars last year. And it's the understanding that throughout the pandemic, we have seen a few key structural themes really accelerating that we think will last well beyond 2021 and will provide very interesting opportunities. ESG clearly is one of them. And I'm not saying going out and just buying broad-based ESG propositions, but the clear focus from governments is to tackle climate change and to make this a green recovery. So the focus on new innovation, the shift in the energy system, will provide investment opportunities. And these are areas we're focusing on to make sure that we understand the implication for companies under our coverage and to invest accordingly. Likewise, technology we've talked a lot about, and it's clearly the most controversial area simply because valuation levels in some pockets of technology have reached levels that will be very difficult to justify, even if we see obviously a big push from earnings growth. And so far, even in 2020, it has been the sector with the strongest earnings delivery. So within technology, clearly, as I've highlighted earlier, cybersecurity, for example, will remain a topic that stays top priority for every company. And even more so, if you think about companies offering flexible working modules in the future, it means that the structure of your technology architecture has to be even more robust, and cybersecurity will remain of utmost importance. Coming back to ESG, topics around obviously clean energy have a link then to electric vehicles, battery value chains, and areas around clean water. These are all topics that we feel have a lot more to give post even 2021, and feel that it allows for a barbell strategy that you have your core markets you want to invest in, and you will complement them with thematic investments. Within the value sectors, we clearly see or have seen a tendency so far that there is potential for consolidation. And what we have been seeing is that within those sectors, the strong are emerging stronger coming out of the pandemic. And again, there's a logic to it, because we know that the stresses across those sectors most impacted have been most severe. If you've had already a stretched balance sheet and have been overlevered, then clearly this will have not been any better throughout the pandemic. And so although we are not seeing the full impact yet, because there's lots of furlough schemes and lots of short-term government support still available, that this is definitely a topic for the first half of 2021, when we will see the full implication, not only across the labor market, but across some of these worst impacted sectors. And again, it will provide opportunity for those companies that can adjust to the new normal and can come out as relative winners from the pandemic. These are topics that we have discussed throughout all of our webinars last year, and it seems that particular with a very strong development in markets, they are even more important in order to think about the relative attractiveness of asset classes, because there was a question on absolute valuation levels. It has to be relative, because from a valuation standpoint on an absolute level, it's very clear that we are seeing quite elevated valuation levels. But given the backdrop, and hence coming back to how I started, if you go along with our assumptions in terms of the relative attractiveness, I think this is the way we would be positioned for 2021. The discussion throughout the year clearly will shift towards the ongoing fiscal support and how this will shape up, so that we obviously eventually will turn our focus towards 2022. And I think that will be a very interesting time, because clearly we are entering a phase where, as Colin has highlighted, the need for monetary policy to hand over to fiscal will determine how 2022 and beyond will look like.
Well, that's a great point on which to end this week's call. And there is indeed a huge amount of themes and topics to consider in future market updates. Thank you, Sonia, Colin and James, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients, for logging in. As a reminder, we have just published our Global Fixed Income Quarterly Outlook, which you can find on LGIM.com, and contains many more insights from Colin and the team.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.